Hey, how are you all doing? My name is Kevan Devani, the host of the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show and the Total Connector Show. As I'm a huge fan, you know, of both Stephanie von Jahn and Eric Kaysen, they both write really deeply enlightening, educational articles, and really appreciate the work. And it's fantastic. It's just fantastic. So we're going to talk together with Stephanie Vunia. We're going to talk with Eric Kaysen, who written a number of beautiful articles on self-sovereignty, crypto sovereignty, Bitcoin. One of them is The Political Theology of Bitcoin on his medium.com page, and the other one is Messianic Bitcoin on his own website, cryptosovereignty.org. And, we talk about the root causes, the very rooted criminality and illegitimacy of the various foundations, the various structures that we are being enslaved by, controlled, and coerced, oppressed, violently oppressed. And the question is, when the central bank is above any law whatsoever, what kind of obedience do we owe to, to these structures, to these entities? Would it be national, supranational, or central banks complicit, in collusion with governments? So really excited to have Stephanie von Jahn and Eric Kaysen on my show back again. And if you have any questions, let me know. Otherwise, please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Kevan Devani, and subscribe to my podcast platforms, anchor.fm/Kevan Devani. And please give me a follow on Twitter. It really helps distribute this knowledge as efficiently as possible. And it also helps my work, my educational work, which I've been doing more than 2 years, Bitcoin only. And thank you so much again for your support and for listening. And without further ado, Stephanie von Jahn and Eric Kaysen.
Okay, welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My very special guests are Eric Kaysen and Stephanie von Jahn. You've been both of you on my show. And so how are you guys doing? Thank you so much for your time.
Doing good this morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, fine. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so as the working title of this episode, Truth But Not Authority Makes Legitimacy, implies, we're going to talk about a bunch of things. I mean, as long as the time allows, because I know Eric is a little bit under time pressure. We got less than an hour, but I think we can, pack in the most essential points we wanted to cover. Look, there are two really, as usual, two excellent articles that you've written and we both read. One of them is The Political Theology of Bitcoin, cryptosovereignty.org on medium.com. And the other one, which I also love, but which I, partially speaking for myself, do not agree maybe to a certain extent, but that's what we're here for. So it's on cryptosovereignty.org on Eric Kaysen's website. And it's called Messianic Bitcoin from September 14, 2020. And there is one paragraph, if I may just quote out of your article. I quote, it's a very, let me just share the screen here so that everybody can maybe knows where we are. So this is the paragraph that somehow for me personally summarizes the essential points or from my comprehension. Here we stand at the edge of a new era, a new dawn from which humanity can rise from the bondage of fiat money and create a radically different future that is better for all. Bitcoin contains the power to create a new commonwealth from cryptography where truth, not authority, becomes the final purveyor of legitimacy. Bitcoin has initiated a struggle against a globalized world order where the nation state and their infinite fiat money and propensity for violence can no longer hold sway for the very thing that signify is not money, wealth, or power, but illegitimacy, incompetence, and evil. Through the infinite power that all states have declared they are entitled to, they have created the very condition that proves their illegitimacy and the need for them to be totally and completely destroyed. I mean, it's just beautiful, you know, also your language, the way you write. This paragraph, this very paragraph sums up many of the points that, Eric, that we have been also talking about, because what I also, you know, love talking about is, you know, this big elephant in the room, the illegitimacy of the central banking structure with its complicit government, which stands above any law whatsoever. So, Stephanie, why don't you just kick it off? Because you had a lot of, you know, detailed questions, but then maybe, you know, I can just come in and comment a little bit, or ask Eric my more specific questions when it comes to those points.
Yeah, Eric, thank you so much for the article. So what really stood out for me is that you said truth is the new legitimacy and not authority. And I haven't seen anyone else like stressing it to this extent. And this is really, really incredible how you were like really bringing this to the focus, that the truth is important, that we go beyond the lies, we go beyond essentially then all the power structures, and that you were actually nailing it down to truth and not some other concept or moral, but to truth. So that was really fascinating. But yeah, I think we can discuss many things. You were also talking about the sovereign exceptions. So essentially to make some exceptions and then to reduce the right of the individual and to push through some, how did you say, emergency legal decrees. Mm. And well, we know how this can look like now. So this is like very on point for the time period we live in. So maybe we go a little bit also in this. But yeah, and also you were, yeah, the Hobbes Leviathan. I saw this in your article that you said, authority, not truth, makes legitimacy. This is what he said. And this is why I thought, oh, wow, you're actually saying the opposite. So we can put this around and say truth is what creates legitimacy and not authority. And this is kind of why we came up with this title for today.
Great. Yeah, I mean, so specifically, like most of this idea specifically that truth, not authority, creates legitimacy is an inversion of the Hobbesian dictum that essentially he uses to surmise the entirety of what he's talking about in Leviathan. And I think it's really interesting because Leviathan being really the first political book on statecraft, he, if you haven't had an opportunity to read it, it's quite an eloquent and difficult read. But he's very pedantic about this idea that the sovereign, because of what he entails in the entirety of, you know, his existence and being, is the law itself, that he can actually circumvent truth through his raw authority. And seeing that, the classic nation state that was created with the Treaty of Westphalia is what we've currently inherited today as the modern nation state. They have pushed this idea to a very, very extreme place where literally whatever they say becomes law, which also ironically is what fiat means in Latin, is to mean let it be done, to just simply create it. And then on the points of the emergency decree or the state of emergency, that's specifically kind of taken from Carl Schmitt and his political theology. And Schmitt's very pedantic about the idea of that the norm doesn't tell us what the law itself actually does. He points out that the exception is what really creates the fullness of the identity of what the law can do. And I think here in the United States, specifically starting, it happened before the Patriot Act, but the Patriot Act was really kind of the first true extreme steps beyond the law through the emergency decree. And here we are 20 years later that the same emergency decrees are still ruling, that the state has actually put itself into this place where it no longer has any tie to any sort of democratic or republican functions, that they're really just various bureaucrats that sort of get to make these emergency decrees that go well beyond any capacity of what the law ever allowed. And what we're seeing now with coronavirus, with these lockdowns, with curfew, with them destroying vast swaths of the economy single-handedly. You know, like I read a statistic that yesterday that here in the Bay Area that half of small businesses have closed. Like that, it's devastating. And I want to be very clear, like I don't want to say that the virus isn't dangerous, that we shouldn't be wary of it, that people shouldn't be trying to protect themselves. But to give this power to the state, it not only is it illegal on its face, but it's very dangerous because like the state isn't exactly known for like giving back power after they've taken it. In addition to the fact that I'm very worried about how they seem to be using the digital panopticon to not only track and catalog people, but there seems to be a very ominous threat of them cataloging and using this data for pretty much whenever they want. They can start labeling people as enemies and depriving them of rights and throwing them into prisons, you know? And so that's kind of what has us arrive at a place that we need to start really discussing how do we resist these things? How do we fight back? How do we create new methodologies to resist, which, you know, has us all be here because Bitcoin seems to be the preeminent object to do that.
Yeah, Rothbard was saying that wars essentially benefit states. So I was always asking who benefits because it's not the population. But after I went into the rabbit hole, I realized, yeah, the state is benefiting from wars because they can then impose more draconian measures that couldn't be imposed during peacetime. And, you know, wars can be taken more broadly, like wars, like war against drugs, war against against the virus, war against terrorism. So not only like the direct fighting wars. So that's just an amazing analysis from him. It was from Anatomy of the State. So
one, I'd even go past that. And both Foucault and Schmitt point this out, is that the sort of wars that we're engaging in now, they're no longer these status boundary wars he uses the word bracketed wars. And by unbracketed wars, he means that these are much larger conflicts that involve citizens and their governments against one another. So much so to the extent that I would actually say, like, we're engaged in a general globalized civil war at this point, where all governments have violated all citizens' rights and procedures constitutionally. And now we're in this place where we actually see, I would call these people the men without law. Like, these are individuals that, because of their authoritarian positions that they've taken in governments, they've given themselves the decrees to step out beyond the power of law itself into their own authoritarian decrees. And it's very scary because, like, there's a long chain of history of seeing what happens when governments declare themselves above and beyond the rights of people. And it usually ends with lots of brutality, murder, and destruction. And I would feel much, much more scared if we didn't have something like Bitcoin and cryptography, because despite how dark everything is, cryptography is this shining light kind of in the darkness that allows for us a real ability to be able to communicate and transact with one another without the state being able to spy on us, which can become the bedrock for us to be able to reorganize ourselves in a much more powerful way.
Eric, you know, when I studied law, I vaguely remember, because I didn't pay that much attention at that time, when it was about law and philosophy, or philosophy of law, or something like that. And there was, I remember there was a guy, a philosopher named Waltz or Walzer, and we were when I read this, it was really very because it was really impressive for me, because the thought of it, because the connection was, of course, you know, with the National Socialism, you know, Nazi Germany, when a law or when a status of you know, of the government or any law enforced or enacted becomes so unjust, so cruel and so atrocious that we human beings have the moral, ethical obligation to defy, to resist, and to not obey. And we are at this point. I mean, what do you think? But the problem is that the governments, as territorial monopolies, as always, also Dr. Thorsten Poller, the Austro economist, always says, have the monopoly, and with its supranational organizations, such as whatever the European Union organizations, for example, any other supranational international organizations with their supranational monopoly on violence, aggression, coercion, enforcement, right? And the threat, you know, to imprison you, whatever. It makes it literally like a life and death thing, because either we're going to defy and to resist and to not obey, or we just have to acquiesce, I think that's the word, you know, to this, to this atrocious, you know, aggressive, coercive, violent entity or entities. I mean, where are we at this point, at this juncture?
Well, I think we're at a very dangerous crossroads, because it's clear that like they're kind of assembling all of the different techniques and abilities to be able to essentially implement kind of Chinese style surveillance across the board on everyone, you know, no matter which nation state that they're in. And furthermore, to your point about the monopoly on violence, it's pretty interesting that states have this sort of secret agreement with one another that their entitlement to violence against their own citizens, that's sort of their own business, within the classic Westphalian idea of what goes on inside of your borders is your business. And I think the truth is that utilizing cryptography and tools like Bitcoin, we can choose to rebuild the internet using strong encryptions and techniques to reorganize and make ourselves much more powerful as various groups of citizens. Or governments are going to take these tools and they're going to use it to spy on us forever and make sure that thought itself becomes a crime, that there becomes an ability to, here in the United States, we have habeas corpus, but it's pretty clear that that's being suspended and that people are being interned in ways that will allow for them to never have a trial. And it's deeply Kafkaesque. It's almost funny with like how Kafkaesque it is, because you know, we have random bureaucrats showing up and arresting people, refusing to tell them what crime they've been committed for, to that they're not, you know, that they haven't even been accused of a crime. And it's a very, very dangerous place. And I would feel much more scared if we didn't have something like Bitcoin. And I feel like as this sort of brinkmanship with the state escalates, where they're going to try to control Bitcoin, try to control people, try to make the lockdowns work, that power is going to start slipping through their hands. And I think the final point is that as people, we need to be ready and prepared for the fact that this could end very poorly, you know, and like as Bitcoiners, I sort of see us as the new international vanguardist class that's willing to stand up and fight against governments. And it's sort of hilarious that at this point in time, like we have all of these kind of contradictions fusing back into each other, that like as Bitcoiners, you know, like we're sort of the preeminent Austrian thinkers that are trying to present this object of free monetary exchange and free markets. Yet we're also taking these sort of deeply socialist ideals, like a revolutionary vanguard, and pushing that to the forefront and saying, people, use this object to help liberate yourself from the slave status of the state. Like, don't let them steal all your wealth. Don't let them destroy your monetary base. And it's really exciting. You know, like I would much rather have this future where we get to fight them as opposed to pushing it off for another generation to need to do that work.
Yeah, you were mentioning the socialist values. So essentially what the socialists did, they took the values of libertarians and then packaged this up into we need a form of state that does everything good for us and like redistributes wealth, and kind of bringing things together that don't fit together, and it's just a contradiction in itself. So yeah.
Well, and what I'd point to is that like anarchism was originally part of the socialist contingency, like in the Working Men's Association, and through Bakun's leadership they eventually split over the idea of utilizing the state to create a dictatorship of the proletariat. And I think it's pretty cool that like we've kind of come full circle to where it's like, hey, check it out. Like there's a way that we can actually fight and destroy the state without needing to go through this oscillation of taking over the state and re-implementing all of its authoritarian decrees in just a different form. And to me, like, that's part of what's messianic, is that we're not talking about another oscillation within the law. Like, we're talking about destroying it and creating something totally new and novel that we've never seen before. And to my point about the messianism is, like, I actually think that this is an eschatological process, because of, as things sort of escalate, I think the state's pretty much going to, like, unmask itself as just being raw authoritarian rule. And on the other side, we're going to have that the actual good and truth of, like, what Bitcoin is, how even if I am somebody that is your adversary that wants to harm you, you can trust in the protocol and what it offers you for the very real truth that's enshrined within it, that even if I'm trying to compromise you in some way, I need to slip around the protocol somehow and do it, you know, through a man in the middle attack or any number of things that's going to expose your private key to me. But if you can actually secure that key yourself, then I don't have a way to overcome that, at least not at this point in time.
So with the power of Bitcoin and the tools that we have, cryptography, you know, the code, the truth, you know, that is so inherent in it, it's all digital. And, you know, we just a couple of minutes before we talked about, you know, violence, aggression, monopoly on aggression, violence enforcement, coercion, you know, and all the criminality that goes with it. My concern is that, you know, I've been brainstorming a lot about this. It's like there's not one criminality that's been not perpetrated and been not committed systematically by the government in collusion with the central banks and their executioners. You know, whether it be rape, systematic theft, wars, plunder, murder, corruption, deepest corruption, deceit, deception, fraud, scientific fraud. I mean, anything you can think of is like there's nothing they haven't done. And I'm like, okay, let's just imagine for a moment we finally got it. We got this intransigence minority, as it is called, or the critical mass adoption. But then I'm like, okay, we got the militarized police, we got the military industrial corporate complex with its intelligence. What are we going to do about that? Because that's the power structure of, you know, the enforcement structure of coercion, right? Of aggression, of violence, of enforcement. So I don't see a problem like dismantling, making like the political structures obsolete with Bitcoin, you know? But what about all these like huge, vast structures that are in existence right now, you know, globally, well, nationally, supranationally?
I think there's kind of two distinct ways that it goes. One is that, you know, it's pretty clear the writing's on the wall that hyperinflation's coming, that central banks of the world have overstepped their bounds and printed out so much money that it's going to have vast and horrible economic consequences. And with that, like, Bitcoin is going to become this preeminent object that continues to accrue more and more wealth and value inside of itself because of its mechanics. And one is like that can become the very real wealth that we'll utilize to try to set up forms and alternatives. And also, like, I frankly believe that, like, the state's probably going to hunt a lot of Bitcoiners down. And, like, it's going to be bad, you know? Like, I don't really expect for myself to come out of this situation relatively unscathed with how big my mouth has been over the last couple of years.
Now you're scaring me, Eric.
You know, like, I'm just trying to be realistic.
We're all exposed, like...
a bit. And I think that goes to show sort of how serious the consequences is. And I've been thinking about this, like, I sincerely believe that Bitcoin is an object of war because of the way that it sort of forces and compels these things. Now, if we're really lucky, what'll happen is we'll go into extreme hyperinflation, that the continuous printing of money will impoverish anybody that's getting a wage that's in USD or whatever fiat form. And hopefully, you know, the armed forces of the world will essentially be like, well, we keep getting this crappy money that doesn't do anything for us. And frankly, we can plead with people, you know, set down your arms. And one of the other more extreme ideas I have is that essentially we invert the panopticon in such a way that it creates surveillance, that we go, look, like, all you people that are out there that are part of governments doing evil shit, like, we know who you are, we know where you live, we know what you're doing. Put down your arms, join us, we'll forgive you. We don't want to harm you, but if you want to arm up and be part of the state, well, check it out. We now have assassination contracts and other things. And I hope it doesn't come to that, but I think the truth is that the panopticon is not going away. And the best thing that we can do is utilize it for the people, for our own freedoms. And I think that the quicker that we can understand, because I think the other thing at the end of the day is that we will always have the population on our side for all of the police and soldiers and individuals that want to perpetrate violence. There's 100 times more people that don't want that. And through us being able to identify people on either side, I think is a huge object of power. I think the more likely scenario is that, like, this drags out into, like, a pretty violent and terrifying conflict where, you know, you have the SS show up in the middle of the night to black bag people and to take them away and not tell them where they're going. That and I think places like here in the United States, because we have the right to bear arms, like, I think it'll get pretty violent. And I think also what people are doing with the manufacturing of arms through 3D printing and other things is an extremely powerful notion and mode that what I would love to see in the United States is essentially that as things get politicized, that we'll try to essentially push all states back or push all power back to state governments as opposed to the federal government. And we'll be able to have a Soviet style dissolution where essentially we say, hey, all 50 states take your share. We'll all go our same ways. Maybe we'll recreate republics together, or we'll just remain independent states. But I mean, stuff's going to get really wild here pretty soon. And it's really hard to see what the outcome is going to look like.
Yeah, so you mentioned violence very often, that you expect that there is more violence, that there's violence between the people and the state, or the state and forces, essentially. So I actually think that when the people start to become violent, this is then the excuse for the government to bring in the military. And, you know, they have arms, you know, here in Germany, we cannot have like guns or anything. So, you know, the people are in a bad situation, let's say, we cannot defend ourselves. In America, it might be a little bit different, you know, but here, I mean, there's no chance. We cannot be violent, actually. And we have a resistance movement that is nonviolent. So they're always saying, they're trying to get more people in, to wake more people up, so that we are becoming the majority. And then that more and more people realize that are actually working for the state, like the police or the soldiers, that they're like on the wrong side, let's say, on the side that it's not for the people. So this is kind of the goal of the resistance movement in Germany. And there's also this peaceful movement. So what do you think about this? Do you think this is really an opportunity to use violence? So as I said, I here in Germany, I don't think so. In America, I cannot assess it really well because I'm not there, but I could consider this maybe it doesn't work so well.
I don't think violence is ever a good option. And I would love for a peaceful, nonviolent movement to lead such a thing. And I really hope that that's how it's going to go, you know, here in the United States as well. I don't have a lot of hope just because of, you know, frankly, because people are so well armed here. But with that being said, I do ultimately think that these movements need to lead themselves through nonviolence, because like if it becomes a violent conflict, like we're just talking about the exact same oscillations of state power all over again. It's just about people trying to mount the political object in order to be able to legitimize their violence, which part of my belief system is like there is no such thing as legitimate violence. Violence in the action of itself is illegitimate. And that's one of the great things is that even if they show up to, you know, black bag me, I have my multi-sig scheme in such a way that, you know, I have individuals that will be able to take my money and hopefully be able to use that to either liberate me or to help further the cause. And speaking to my point about surveillance, like I think that that's one of the techniques that can really be utilized in a powerful way in a nonviolent method, is that once you actually identify these people that are perpetrating these pretty horrific crimes, I think, what was it, in Serbia, there was the Op Door movement, which was part of when Serbia was under the rule of Slobodan Milosevic, and there was deep brutality that was going on by the police forces, what these people chose to do was document the police that were committing these crimes, and then literally go to, you know, their kid's school and be like, hey, well, like, check it out. This is Jimmy's dad. He's, like, raping this woman. Like, Jimmy, you should, like, go home and, like, talk to your family about this. And these police got so embarrassed about what these horrible things they were doing that when it came time to, like, show up to next to protest to, like, beat people down, they're like, you know, like, I'm out. Like, I don't want to participate anymore because of how horrific it is. And to me, like, that's also one of the refreshing things is that even the people that are involved in these deeply authoritarian movements, I do think that they can be reached through showing, hey, like, this isn't good. You shouldn't be doing this. And then I think even those that can't be reached, that ultimately becomes a question about what do we do when we confront direct evil? You know, when there are these people that are doing these horrific crimes and they can't recognize what it is, I think that's where we start to ask ourselves, how are we going to respond to it? And I think that there's many, many powerful methodologies that don't involve violence. Mm-hmm. And that's my deepest hope for it. And that's one of the things that also makes me believe that Bitcoin is messianic, is that like it's a totally non-violent object of exchange that has no physicality about it. So it entertains these deeply non-violent notions much, much better than violence, which, you know, ultimately comes back to this world and people taking up arms or whatever against one another. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Eric. Thank you very much. I totally agree with that.
Eric, you know, as it is, you know, evolving right now, you know, the adoption rate by institutions, whatever, companies, and maybe even soon pension funds. And now, you know, we heard that Iran's central bank or National Bank of Iran has somehow pushed for the enactment of a law that somehow enables the purchase of Bitcoin directly from the miners in Iran. So what I'm trying to get at is that, do you think we're going then maybe towards sort of a transitional phase into sort of a competitive phase where, you know, jurisdictional arbitrage, governments and nation states are now competing with one another, and that is, you know, sort of, beneficial for this whole process, and also just one more point is, like you said, you know, I mean, I know I don't want to like paint it all negative, but it's like a lot of people within the governmental or even military structure or, you know, intelligence structures, these are like family people too, you know. It's like, it's not like everything white and black. There's a plea people within these structures. I mean, if we just take whatever Edward Snowden or you know, people like these, you know, who are insiders who do want to, you know, who have family of themselves, who do exactly what's going on, you know, who have been really deep down the rabbit hole, and maybe they want to help. Maybe there are many more whistleblowers, insiders, and people who want to help, you know, who want to come out of this rabbit hole and really come, you know, to the side of the light, you know. But do you think this is all coming together, like converging?
I do. And this is one of my deepest hopes, is that, like, through this engagement, kind of initiating with Iran's central bank starting to accumulate Bitcoin through miners selling it, to me, that there's no way that intelligence communities across the world don't look at that and make that into a national security imperative. I would be very surprised if in the United States that there haven't been national security briefings around this and about the need to start putting both energy and capital accumulation towards Bitcoin, which is really great, because this forces us into a neo-mercantilist era where essentially the accumulation of Bitcoin is going to help really ensure that utilizing these violent methodologies and that continuing to print and create money, it's just not going to work. And furthermore, like, as Bitcoin forces this agenda of legitimacy, I do think that I'd say the majority of people that are involved in the intelligence communities, I actually think that they sincerely have their heart in the right place, but there hasn't been a deep enough philosophical discussion and inquiry in themselves to really understand what's happening. And I think that part of this is going to force those sort of dialogues. And my great hope is that like by the time the war against the Bitcoiners is really to initiate, there's going to be enough people on the inside that'll be like, whoa, whoa, hey, no, like what we need to do is actually integrate this into our forms of government, realize we can't print money infinitely, to actually have programs that acknowledge this. And that's really one of the greatest highlights, is maybe this intellectual war is already being carried out. And I actually have another piece on my blog called Theory of the Crypto Partisan, which is essentially about how the topology of war has now opened up to include the entirety of the internet. But furthermore, because of the way that people can kind of put on the cloak of anonymity and go into the web and maintain that, there's a very real possibility that there are people deep within the national security networks that are already on our side, that are doing maybe development work for Bitcoin, or are ensuring that, you know, the correct algorithms that can't be cracked are being selected for things that, you know, that things like Schnorr signature are going to be able to actually get deployed and not have any sort of vulnerabilities about them. And to me, like, it's all of these assemblages of things that are sort of operating together that, to me, is what allows for Bitcoin to be messianic, because it's forcing this actual ontological questioning of, like, what human existence means, what security is, what wealth is, what commonality that we share is all about. And it's really powerful and incredible, because I think for the first time, we're starting to see global humanity recognizing itself first and foremost as global humanism, as opposed to various identities of nationalities.
Very enlightening, Eric, very enlightening. I totally agree with you. And you know what? I mean, the reason also I'm doing this podcast is like to give people not only the educational tools, materials, you know, people like you and Stephanie von Jahn, you know, she writes also, you know, beautiful articles, and it's all about education. But, you know, in order to not to stay, you know, in this echo chamber or in this intellectual niche, is like give people not only hope, but some, you know, realistic vision. You know, not utopia, but a vision. Like, and I'm sometimes I'm somehow desperate, because I'm like, why are you people, you know, why is humanity not waking up and seeing what it is? It's, you know, you've probably read also Robert Breedlove's articles about how much time we've been lost. I mean, we've been losing and been stolen from mm-hmm. by the central banks and the governments. You know, I mean, how many trillions of hours of time, and time converts to me, you know, what does it mean, like, in practicality? I mean, it means the technological innovation has been stolen from us, the abundance, the prosperity, the freedom, the joy, you know? So I don't know, maybe if we want to, the last 10, 15 minutes, just wrap this a little bit up, but I'll give you both the floor. I mean, what do you guys think, I mean, is possible with Bitcoin, rooted a humanity, a society, a human civilization rooted in Bitcoin?
I mean, that's a big question. I mean, to honestly answer it, like, I can't answer that. What I can say is that it's so far beyond what we can imagine. Like, this time theft that's been engaged in, it has calcified our vision of what a life looks like, what it means. I mean, like, the very real functions of the hours of the clock, you know, like that. There is nothing in the material world that, like, has these numbers that correlates to it. The sun rises, the sun sets, and, like, those are the real functions of time. And so, because we've been so deeply embedded in you know, this capitalist slave labor mentality of I get up, I work at a job, I come home, we're just so far removed from our own forms of life that aren't tethered to this thing, that aren't part of a gigantic nation state that, you know, proceeds over us bureaucratically. And my hope is that with Bitcoin, this totally new form of private life that like I can't see, it's sort of encrypted to me, if you will, that anybody can have. And I guess the best corollary that I can have is, like, I'm a burner, and I've been to Burning Man, like, you know, a dozen times or something. And life out there is just a complete, wacky, insane, crazy trip that's really beautiful and so different and removed from anything that you can experience in this world, that my hope is that a world that Bitcoin can create is like a much larger version of that, of sincere anarchy, but with that being said, not a form of chaos, but like very similar to nature, that there are all of these fitting and moving pieces that work together that creates this incredible bloom of humanity that's well beyond anything that I could actually describe here. And just know that it's a very beautiful form of life that is a private one that people get to have full sovereignty and agency over themselves and how they choose to create that with one another.
It's so cool that you mentioned Burning Man. So I was on Ozara. It's one of the biggest psychedelic festivals. And nice. It's also, I think it's, there are like many similarities. I've been to other festivals as well. In the freedom that you experience there, this other form of life, just being in the moment, just, you know, celebrating, enjoying life with other people. Also this community aspect, we don't have this anymore in our life. I mean, actually, if we could really start to think in which system are we living in? I mean, we are, as you said, we wake up, go to work, come home, we're exhausted. Then we have to pay all the taxes. I mean, we have to pay taxes on so many things, on our income. If we own property, we have to pay tax on a property. There's even a tax on having a dog, I realized recently. I mean, it's just insane. They're getting your money out of the pockets, like in all ways. Also, when you consume things, you have to pay VAT, like VAT on it, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and then I was always thinking, okay, I compared this to nature and I see like the beings that live in nature, like the animals, the wild animals in nature, they can just, you know, build their houses. Like I had a look at the beaver building his house and I was thinking, we cannot do this, because then the police and the authorities come and say, yeah, you don't own this property and you don't have they have like authorities to tell you whether you can build something and how high it can be and all these crazy things. So they put you into the small box, and this is how your whole life was framed. You cannot be creative, you cannot be free, you have to stick to the system. And this system is a complete slavery system. And mm-hmm. I haven't realized this a couple of years ago. I just took it as it is because this is what I was born into. I never questioned it. But now going through this whole libertarian idea on how could it look like having no state? Most people don't know that this is possible. I think it would be like chaos, everything's like burning. No, it's not. It could be freedom for the people. And this is also like very smart of the state and of the whole educational system and also the media to frame it in this way that, yeah, we need the state and it serves us and it keeps us safe. And in fact, this is a complete lie.
Absolutely.
And this lie is coming to the surface now.
I mean, I think coronavirus kind of helps frame this the best, is that it's done through a rule of fear and terror. Like it's not about us as humans trying to stand up and work together in order to create safety and security. And ultimately, I think it's sort of hilarious that like in Leviathan, Hobbes is like, look, like a life in nature is like this brutish, terrible existence of the war of all against all. And like the truth is that Rousseau's critique of that, like it's not true. Like you have the ignoblest, you know, man out in nature who like he doesn't know or understand these things of violence. And I think that there's a real potential to return to a life without the state that is really beautiful and powerful and entails all of these really new and different ideas. And as much as we desire that, like, I think the truth is that we're going to run into a lot of people that are so deeply locked into their fear and terror that they, frankly, like, they would much rather turn the apparatus of the state against us to destroy us than to allow for us the freedom to try to create what we want on our own. And I think that process, I really hope what will happen is that, you know, we'll choose to break off on our own and build our own societies together. But it's hard to see, you know, like the most that I can say is that Bitcoin gives me a kind of security that I don't think can be found anywhere else, with the exception of a life that is actually in nature by yourself where you can build a home and like the entity of the state doesn't exist. Like there's no person that can descend upon you and say, I have the authority to destroy this or take this from you or give me part of this. And I think it's pretty interesting that like we live in a day and age where, you know, like you tell people taxation is theft and they like laugh at you. They're like, oh, that's like a ridiculous notion, which to me shows how far we have to go in terms of disassembling the ideological framework that's been given to us. And coronavirus is a great opportunity because like at least here in the United States, like the education system's been pretty thoroughly smashed. They're trying to reestablish it in different ways, but a lot of people don't want to go back into it. And I think that coronavirus is giving us a really powerful opportunity to see how misleading the state is. Like it's pretty clear that these bozos have made this conflict much worse, have really destroyed the economy, haven't actually corrected the problems that's been presented. And I'm really hoping that people really see the nakedness that the emperor has insofar that not only are they not helping us, but they're like stealing from us. They're printing out for all of their friends and family. They're doing these extremely draconian lockdowns and other things. And ultimately, you know, the tertiary cost of this is people are suffering incredible amounts, you know, and you know, like I'm in a secure place. I own Bitcoin. I live in a small town. I have family and friends amongst me. Most people don't have this stuff and they're suffering. And it really breaks my heart that instead of people choosing to say, you know, maybe this state thing isn't serving us in the way that I believe it, they want to double down and be like, we just need to give more power to the state. That's what'll really solve it. Mm-hmm. And it's scary because I'm not sure how you overcome that mentality of such a deep and pervasive fear that governs a person's entire being, that they would choose to give up all of their freedom and liberty based upon this false promise that they'll be secured through the state.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned actually the Stockholm syndrome, where those that got abused are then loving the abuser because they gave him like some little candy. And this is exactly what we're in, actually. The people are abused. This is a kind of form of abuse when you are like stuffed into the system where you are a slave, more or less, and where you are told propaganda and all this stuff, and where you're told how to behave. I mean, this is not freedom, and this is not how a human being can be. But yeah, the people already got so used to this abuse that they're not seeing this. But fortunately, more and more wake up. So we see, but I agree, it's tough.
Yeah, and you know, we're all part of that awakening as well. Like I think we, you know, Stephanie, you had your own libertarian awakening, and you know, I had mine as well. And I think with all of the content that we're producing, with the new dialogues that can be had with Bitcoin, I think that this is a part of a very powerful intergenerational process where my hope is that when my children grow up, there's no question about, you know, the sort of political ideals that they have, the sort of money that they want to use, and the sort of lives that they want to build. And, you know, as dark as everything is, I do see this very beautiful light that's shining for us to follow, not just through Bitcoin and cryptography, but more of the real knowledge and agency that we gain through understanding how these practices work. And furthermore, as we develop them more and gain new connections with other people, that's just going to bloom out into a much larger and more powerful movement, to where I hope eventually it comes to a climax where we make a choice to say, you know, we're going to start creating new institutions for the future that are going to better ourselves, our families, our friends, and really help rebuild community in a way that, in my opinion, has been totally extinguished for, you know, several generations. And it will be very powerful to get to participate in that. And to me, the power of that and the risk in choosing to do that is so much more beautiful and profound than, you know, the 100 years of life that they're offering of living in this immaculate cage.
Beautiful said, Eric. You know, it makes me somehow simultaneously sad. I'm sad, I'm shocked, I'm really intrigued and surprised. And it's, you know, when I talk to my girlfriend and we talk about, you know, how people around us, whether it be friends, family members, you know, like they don't question anything. You know, it's like, oh my God, I mean, I don't want to even start off with Bitcoin because, or the monetary system or the structural system. It's like, they don't question anything, you know? And it's like, it's usually like a lot of, if you go on the mainstream or forums, you know, it's like the so-called people, you know, who are more educated, you know, who are more academics, you know, these are the people who actually, you know, who are the first ones to attack you, you know, or anybody, like attack anybody who is, you know, who is like deviating from the norm, from the official narrative. You're, you know, instantaneously, you know, you're whatever, conspiracy theorist, a criminal, whatever you want to, you're a murderer. It's insane. And I just don't get it, you know, that people are not questioning. They don't see what's coming. And what I was also going to say is like, these people are depending on the, you know, on the level of the political or the power structure. I think some of them know exactly what's going on. They know exactly what's coming, that shit is going to hit the fan. And, you know, with the insolvencies coming, you know, the Euro crash, whatever that is, you know. But I'm sure, you know, Stephanie, you know, can be more, a little bit more elaborated and articulated about that, you know, what's really coming. I mean, yeah. And that's why they need this distraction with whatever it is, COVID hysteria.
I mean, I think a lot of people, like, it's similar to a cult, you know, like there's a great documentary on Scientology that, like, once you finally get to the deeper levels, like, you realize this shit's just completely batshit crazy, but they've invested their entire life in it. Like, you know, what does the individual who's served 25 years in the intelligence agency, when he finally realizes, like, oh, like, I'm participating in a vehicle that's literally killing children. Like, I would love for them to have the bravery to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to participate in this, but I don't think they're actually possible. It's possible for them. And I'm not sure what to tell them other than hoping that at some point in time there is some sort of ethical dilemma that is loud enough for them to choose to turn away. But I don't really expect that. And I think, to the point about academia, is like, it's really just another form of authoritarianism of, you know, people have spent 20 years of their life getting A's and being celebrated and being told that they have experience in this field. And I think it's hilarious because, like, in my experience, turning away from all of these people and choosing to go all in on Bitcoin early on, you know, it completely changed my life and gave me a security in a way that I would have never had before. Meanwhile, they're like, no, like, you need to work 40 years of your life. You need to put all your money into your 401k. You need to trust that this system's going to work. And if you suck the dick like how you're supposed to, you'll get a little bit at the end. You know, and it's really sad because instead of them stopping and saying, maybe if I take a risk on myself, maybe if I trust my own belief systems, maybe something better will come about for myself. And for me, that was the real turning for myself, was when I was really getting into Bitcoin. I was getting all this information. And, you know, I talked to people about it and they're like, no, like, stay away from this. And I had this moment where I was like, no, I would rather take a risk on this and choose to have it blow up on me than to continue participating in their slave labor system. And because I made that choice to take my capital and risk it in such a way, it paid off for me in an extraordinary way. And I hope I have the same hope for other people that they'll make the same choice, because, you know, your 401k is going to get liquidated and destroyed in the coming in the coming monetary apocalypse. And it's going to be a sad state of affairs.
Beautifully said. Eric, I know you got to go in a few minutes. You want to close up, like, any other final thoughts or any other articles that you're going to be publishing soon, or,
you know, website? So much of my creative process is kind of a poetic thing that, like, is out of my sort of purview and control. But I just finished a piece for the next edition of the Bitcoin Times that's going to be coming out. That's about Bitcoin in the state of emergency explicitly. And I deal with the Schmittian concept of what the state of emergency is. And I contrast that against Walter Benjamin's theses on history, where he, in the seventh point, he presents that through us understanding the real state of emergency, which is essentially us objecting and fighting back, we actually have a real chance to fight against fascism and win. And to me, Bitcoin's the real state of emergency because of, well, one, the state will actually induce a state of emergency directly by saying, hey, we got to destroy this thing before it destroys us. And to me, that's actually kind of the apocalyptic moment for the state, where there's this opportunity for us to destroy it without shedding a drop of blood. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also working on something I call the pedagogy of Bitcoin, which is essentially about how the methodologies and models of our learning have been done to kind of trap us in this authoritarian system. And that through the autodidactic means of the internet, there's this real capacity for us to learn and change our perspectives in a powerful way that can aid us much more deeply. But who knows? I gotta find both the time and the capacity to actually get things published. But I really love and appreciate the work that you do in helping, you know, both spread my work and the work of many other individuals in this field. And it's always so great just to connect with like minds and deepen the solidarity around our mutual mission of Bitcoin and liberating the world from fiat slavery.
Eric, thank you so much. Somewhere in one or two instances in your article, you talked about love. And, you know, with all the sadness and desperation and sometimes really anger, that, you know, sometimes I have the feeling we're not moving forward, but even, you know, trying our best, doing whatever it takes to educate our, you know, brothers and sisters out there. But, you know, it's in the end, at the end of the day, it's about, you know, unconditional love and empathy and truth and transparency and just, you know, sowing the seed. And, you know, the cat is out of the bag. We got Bitcoin and it's, and I think, Brendan Quittam, who writes, you know, about mycelium. So I think the network's already there, like this vast network, you know, of interconnectedness is already there. But maybe, like we talked just about, you know, recently about psychedelics, maybe it's more, Bitcoin is more sort of very extremely subtle, very slow, very micro dosages of psychedelics, I think, you know, for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like it's psychedelic insofar that it's this assemblage of thought that's totally unique and different that you would have never expected before. But once you get that hit of it, it changes your perspective almost entirely, you know? And I've even thought so far that, like, there's probably some crazy dynamic feedback between Bitcoin and psychedelics. And so far of that, there are these similar thought modules, the actual possession of psychedelics through Bitcoin. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like, the knowledge that we're trying to share with others is a form of love, because like it's a respectful kind of love that says, you know, I love you and respect you enough that I want you to have this form of wealth that even if I am against you and I want to take it from you, I can't, you know? And so please entertain it, because, you know, I love you and I love humanity, and I want humanity to have this opportunity for us to actually have a form of wealth that can't be extracted from one another via any form of legalized violence or otherwise.
Nothing to say. It's beautiful. Okay, Eric, Stephanie, you got any final thoughts? I mean, I'm going to reflect a little bit, a few minutes with Stephanie once you're gone, but anything else you want to tell Eric or ask Eric?
Yeah, maybe I briefly mentioned this. So you, Kayvan, said that you have some issues when talking with others, that they're not listening. And what I learned from this, I mean, of course, I also tried to like bring some of the truth forward, but some, they are just not ready. And then it doesn't help if we push them. So what I decided is that I'm working as much on myself as I can to release any fears, because we also learn fears can make you manipulatable, and then you can be controlled and steered in some way. But not closing down the heart, but still being compassionate to the self and to the others, and still be loving. And then going forward on the path in the inside. When you can't do it in the outside, then you need to do it in the inside. So maybe this is the last thing that I wanted to like share.
Excellent. I love it. And yeah, at the end of the day, love is really what's kind of propelling us forward, and choosing to shed that fear and to lead with an open heart is the most powerful thing that we can do in helping educate and spread awareness of what we're really trying to do. So thank you both so much for having me and having this wonderful dialogue. It's always so exciting to get to share in this way. And I I deeply appreciate both of you with wanting to explore this with me. It's really fun, and I really, really enjoy it. So thank you both so much.
Talk
to you soon. Thanks so much.
All right, see you guys later. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, Stephanie. So I really thanks so much for your time, and it was excellent question you asked, and it was a really nice flow. You know, fear is you know, a form of energy, and I think people need to learn within themselves and for themselves, like how to convert this negative energy, this fear energy, into whatever creative energy. You know, often I say, you know, out of necessity, out of pain, suffering comes, you know, this process of creativity or you know, transformation, reflection. So what did you think?
Well, I have quite a lot to say on fear, actually. So I had my extreme awakening in September 2017. I have experienced kind of energies moving through my body, and it like really broke open my heart. And by opening this heart, I became aware of so many emotions I had no idea that there were. And they all came actually kind of rushing over me. It was really hard because I never learned really how to handle them. I started a little bit of meditation a couple of weeks before. That was so good. Otherwise, it would have been even worse. And I somehow was in a situation and I needed to like handle it and survive kind of the emotion storms around me. And I had so much like fear also coming up, and fear is like a really like sharp, it's like it goes on all your, it's a really unnice feeling also when you feel it in your body and you're like, you want to flee and run and, you know, everything is under tension. But at one point, I learned how to really stay in the body in this moment, to really feel it in the body. And then I realized that it actually wasn't that bad, because then you just feel it as some kind of dark whale that is like going on your body and mind. And I was just sitting there and waiting. And actually, it was for 40 minutes. And I can't tell you how much fear I transformed in this moment. And it was actually kind of life-changing for me. It was also fear of death that triggered this moment. Mm-hmm. And well, interestingly, a little bit later, I realized some more details about the secret of what happens after we leave this body. So it is so crucial to go into these fears and to not fear it. Fear, it's always fear of, how is it called? Fear of something, fear of something that is uncertain, or that this fear doesn't make sense, in fact. So always when I had these kind of fears, I later learned that actually it is nothing to fear. It's just kind of an illusion, and it's not that bad. So yeah, that was not the end. Fears can be triggered every now and then. So I worked extremely hard on existential fears. I started 1 year ago to like really focus on this, and it goes really deep into my childhood as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Bitcoin bust, so when it goes down, it always triggers some fears, you know, but that's awesome. You know, Bitcoin is also teaching you how to handle emotions. And then, you know, not to just push it away and to compartmentalize, but yeah, to allow this in your body and to become a whole by reclaiming all these parts of yourself that you have lost when you split up a part of yourself by experiencing the emotion.
Right, right. And you know, it's hardly known that a lot of well-known or, you know, famous scientists or experts we know in different fields have either had, many of them, you know, even Steve Jobs or, you know, anybody, entrepreneurs, inventors, engineers, scientists, many of them had or have had, you know, either psychedelic experiences or near-death experiences. And I think it's a wake-up call. So, you know, every human being, every soul has a different trigger or a key. And for me, you know, it definitely was one of them, essentially psychedelic mushroom experiences. I mean, I gotta, you know, admit that. And it made me face, you know, my own fears, so-called demons, you know, the fear of death also. And this is why it's now being rediscovered, you know, in therapies, in by a lot of, you know, holistic doctors, in, you know, whether it be depressive people or suicidal people or cancer, you know, cancer sick people. So so yeah, we could go, you know, very deep into this rabbit hole, but I think it is all interconnected. You know, Bitcoin, the essence of Bitcoin, and the whole transformational space that we're within, it's all interconnected. So yeah, so thank you so much again for your insights and your, you know, sharing your thoughts and vision.
You're welcome.
All right, okay, Stephanie, talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
All right, bye.
Okay, so I really love this interview. I really love this talk, this conversations. I mean, it really goes into so many deep rabbit holes. Please make sure you like, subscribe my YouTube channel, follow me on Twitter. It's the heartblood of my work. And also subscribe to my different podcast platforms. Write a positive review, a 5-star rating review if you really loved it. And yeah, and if you have any wishes or questions for any future guests or topics, please let me know. My email address is hello@thetotalconnector.com. You can reach me by DM or email or Telegram. And thank you so much again for support and for listening. And I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did.